You're listening to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, here from New York City.
And this is Prashant Parameswaran from Washington, D.C.
How are you doing today, Prashant?
Good. How are you doing?
Doing well. It's good to have you back from Asia. We haven't done a podcast together in a while. But looking forward to picking up where we left off. We've got some big news, of course, in the final days of October. So just for listeners, this episode is going to focus a little bit on a topic we've discussed previously on the podcast, which is the position and the future of the Islamic State in the Asia-Pacific region. Of course, on October 27th, U.S. President Donald Trump announced in an address to the nation here that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the longstanding leader of the Islamic State, he was responsible for the group's rise. He'd announced the caliphate, the global caliphate in 2014 in Iraq. Baghdadi had been announced to have been killed in a raid conducted by the United States. So Baghdadi died apparently after detonating a suicide vest during this raid on his compound near the Syrian town of Idlib by U.S. Army Delta Force personnel. This ended basically what was a near decade-long hunt for him. He's been a wanted terrorist for much longer, but his profile certainly rose after rising to the top of the Islamic State's caliphate. So his death has been confirmed now by the Islamic State, which in an audio message released a few days after the raid, confirmed that Baghdadi was dead, that a new successor had been appointed named Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Quraishi. So it looks like, as far as we can tell right now, although it is still very early days, that ISIS has simply replaced its leader with another gentleman. Its territorial caliphate in Iraq and Syria continues to be in fairly dire shape. But Prashant, as we've discussed before, I mean, without the territorial caliphate, ISIS has been quite successful in inspiring other groups to pledge allegiance, even less established groups in the Asia-Pacific region. So when we look at this development and we think more about the future of ISIS-inspired extremism and terrorism in Asia, what can we expect?
Yeah, I mean, I think that sense is right, which is that this is definitely a significant development in terms of the Islamic State. And, you know, it's another big loss for the group. Baghdadi is not a leader that's going to be easily replaceable. And this is essentially the highest profile leader that's been killed or captured since Osama bin Laden back in 2011. So it's significant. But as you correctly noted, you know, how it's going to affect Asia and trends in the Asia Pacific is less clear. And that's due to a couple of reasons. One is, I mean, we really don't know, as you pointed out, we've got a new appointment now of a leader. We really don't know much about al-Quraishi. In fact, even some of the people who look at the Islamic State very closely still know very little about him thus far. So how the group is going to shape up and what its future shape is going to be, we don't really know. But also, a lot of the patterns of extremism and radicalism that we see in the region, they're as much the product of local and regional dynamics as they are about the Islamic State as a global force, right? So, you know, for example, last month, you know, you had one of Indonesia's most senior security officials was stabbed, and that had to do with a group that had some connections to ISIS, but they were operating fairly autonomously. So these groups are going to continue to be operating as they are. Just, you know, it's the Islamic State that's kind of taken the hit, so to speak. And then the other part of this that we don't know is, I mean, there is this pattern, and we saw this in the video with the Islamic State spokesman that came out following Baghdadi's death, that, you know, there might be a potential for the Islamic State to actually try to, you know, engineer some kind of reprisal or some kind of comeback. And it may not necessarily be in the Middle East. It might be in Europe. It might be in Africa. It might be in Asia and Southeast Asia. So I think a lot of security forces might be, on the one hand, you know, sort of encouraged that this development has occurred, but also being on guard as to whether their regions or their countries might be targets for those kinds of revenge or reprisal killings.
Yeah, no, I think the point on the autonomy of regional groups is an important one, especially when it comes to examining how ISIS has been so successful in inspiring attacks overseas, even as its territory in Iraq and Syria has really undergone dramatic change after the success of the military campaigns there. But you know, I think another good example is the terrible Easter attacks in Sri Lanka earlier this year, which killed over 250 people. I mean, that attack was largely carried out by an autonomous group. There's still questions about the extent to which ISIS might have directly been the ISIS leadership, Baghdadi himself perhaps, might have been involved in directing that attack. And certainly there are sort of domestic political and the domestic political strife in Sri Lanka has certainly contributed to the rise of those groups like the National Tauhid Jamaat, which was the group that ended up being attributed with the Easter attacks. So I agree. I mean, I think it'd be useful for our listeners though to just maybe have a little bit of an overview of the state of sort of ISIS affiliates around the region. So do you want to start a little bit by telling us about the scene right now in Asia, primarily, I guess, in the Philippines and Indonesia?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think the way to think about it is you've had a number of Islamic State-linked groups that have carried out high-profile attacks over the past few years. The biggest example in the Philippines that we saw in the news was when we had Islamic State militants actually take control of the southern city of Marawi back in 2017. And that was an example of a group that was actually linked to the Islamic State, but was similarly operating autonomously. Other than that, you have other groups in Indonesia that operate a little bit more autonomously, including the grouping that I mentioned targeted Indonesia's top security official last month. They're also operating there. But in the Philippines and in a lot of the other Southeast Asian countries, you have groups that are operating with either some sort of connection to the Islamic State or some kind of allegiance, but they're actually operating fairly autonomously. A good example in the southern Philippines is, you have groups like the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, you have groups like the Abu Sayyaf. Some factions of these have actually talked about some linkages to global terrorist groups, but these are primarily local conflicts, and essentially they're links to external groups, whether it's the Islamic State or previously incarnations like Al-Qaeda, has always remained fairly limited in that sense. And then I think we should also broaden it to include, and this is tough, right? Because we want to distinguish between terrorism and violent extremism and also other forms of radicalism and potential radicalism. But we've talked in this podcast before about the Rohingya crisis and how it is a human rights tragedy what's going on with respect to the Rohingya crisis and the Uyghurs in Xinjiang. But there's always a potential, and security officials are always worried about this, a risk of dissent turning into radicalism and then potential violent extremism. So that's a whole another category in East Asia, I think, that we're sort of dealing with as well.
And just to pick up on South Asia a little bit. So we talked a little bit about the Sri Lankan attacks, but a few weeks after those attacks in May this year, for the first time, ISIS declared a province, what it called its wilayats, in India, and that was at a particularly hot time in Kashmir too. So this was the Kashmiri province that they announced, and obviously Kashmir remains hot, and there's a lot of concern, especially among Indian security officials, that going forward, the situation in Kashmir might invite ISIS and its affiliates from around the region. Certainly in the Afghanistan-Pakistan theater, ISIS has long established its Khorasan province, what they call the Khorasan province, working with sort of residual fighters from a range of groups based in those countries, including fallen off fighters from the Afghan and Pakistani Taliban who have signed up with ISIS. And ISIS certainly remains very active in Afghanistan. But yeah, I mean, a high-profile Islamic State attack has not yet come to India, and there is a lot of concern in New Delhi that India will be a likely target in the coming years. Indian intelligence officials have been keeping a close eye on sort of ISIS activities in the periphery. In fact, the Sri Lankan attack reports afterwards quickly showed that there was a failure by Sri Lankan intelligence to take warnings from New Delhi about a possible attack seriously. So India is keeping a close eye on the development of ISIS around the region. But mostly, I mean, I think we do continue to see the group's nexus in the Southern Asian region being primarily in that AFPAC theater, unsurprisingly. And especially there's concerns now, if the United States does proceed with what appears to be a drawdown strategy in Afghanistan, that could cause blowback for India, certainly in Kashmir, but also in other parts of the country. And then across the region elsewhere, there have long been concerns in Bangladesh, which in 2016 saw an attack carried out again by largely autonomous fighters, sort of young militants who'd been influenced by the group's ideology, who took over a bakery in Dhaka, taking more than, I believe, a dozen people hostage. And in the Maldives, in the Indian Ocean, there's long been concerns about the Islamic State's resurgence. Maldives, at one point, was the country with the highest per capita Islamic State fighters. It's a small country, but given its size, it was contributing a disproportionately large amount of fighters to the Islamic State's physical caliphate in the Middle East. So I think it's fair to say that the region will remain on high alert after Baghdadi's death. I think you're right that the idea of a reprisal attack is probably in the Islamic State's MO. That's how they operate. They've operated similarly after sort of setbacks in the Middle East, certainly when Mosul was under siege and the Islamic State was losing territory quickly. We saw some of those attacks around the world as well. So I think we can close our discussion on ISIS there, but I did want to talk about our usual topic, usually at this time of the year in Asia, which is the upcoming summits. November is always summit season for Asia-Pacific leaders, and we have a couple interesting developments. So the first one, I think the big one, is the cancellation of the 2019 Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, or APEC, summit in Chile. The Chilean president, Sebastián Piñera, announced that Chile was really in no condition to host the summit, given the protests and riots taking place across the country right now. Domestic security is a concern. It's not just APEC. He's also calling off the upcoming UN climate summit. So there's that. And then there's also the issue of the East Asia summit, the U.S. ASEAN summits, and in fact, all of the ASEAN summits that take place and will take place in Bangkok this year's chair. So why don't we talk a little bit first about the significance of the cancellation of APEC? Because I think in most news stories, the big focus is on the fact that the United States and China now have no backdrop for what was supposed to be a phase one trade deal. Of course, you know, that might have been optimistic to begin with, because as we've seen with the trade war process, things ebb and flow. But what do you think the other impacts it might be of the cancellation of this year's APEC summit?
I mean, I think it has to do more with, as you pointed out, the sort of context more than the actual agenda items. Because for APEC, it's been one of those forums that there's a lot of working level groups that take place on economic issues, trade issues, investment issues that go on irrespective of what happens, whether, you know, the high level summit meetings are held. There are all these working groups that meet throughout the year, and you have at various levels progress that's being made. But I think this is coming in the midst of, as you pointed out, the U.S.-China quest for a trade deal, and that's been dominating the headlines. But also, I mean, we have been dealing with in the past few years sort of doubts about multilateralism and countries struggling to deal with their own national issues and dynamics with multilateralism more generally. And so we had been dealing with it so far with other fora such as the World Trade Organization and other sort of minilateral agreements like TPP being in stress. But APEC was actually seen as one of those summits and meetings that was actually, you know, fairly immune from that, relatively speaking. But, you know, the fact that we have this going on now in Chile is just testament to the fact that we really do have a big problem on our hands in terms of multilateralism. The other thing that is interesting in this context is, you know, this year we have Chile dealing with its domestic dynamics and how it's going to manage a summit. We have a similar dynamic as well going on in Thailand and the ASEAN dynamics. But next year, Malaysia is going to be the chair of APEC, right? Yeah. And that's another case of a government that is dealing with a lot of domestic political uncertainties. I mean, this is a government that came to power last year, having to deal with a lot of domestic issues, economic issues, political issues, and they're going to have to manage dealing with a summit next year as well. And that, I think, is part of the reason why we actually haven't heard a lot from Malaysia on the actual agenda next year for APEC. So I certainly hope we don't see an overt cancellation of the summit, and I don't think we will. But it nonetheless is testament to the fact that these countries have a lot of domestic stuff to deal with, even as they're dealing with a lot of these foreign policy, multilateral issues as well.
Yeah, no, I think that was a helpful summary. And APEC often gets misread, like the purpose of the organization. It's 21 members, it's consultative, it's not a negotiation forum, it's certainly not a regulatory body on trade, but its value really, and especially at the summit level, has been to provide an important forum for leaders from around the Pacific Rim to meet. For instance, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was expecting to have a pretty important another important bilateral meeting with Vladimir Putin. That meeting doesn't look like it's going to happen at all now, with the cancellation of the APEC summit. Of course, it might be rescheduled. So it's interesting when you have a development like this sort of upset everybody's calendar at the end of the year. But what's also interesting is that the Trump administration has had a very checkered record when it comes to the ASEAN summits, including the East Asia summit. The Obama administration managed to have the president go to every East Asia summit except the 2013 iteration when there was a government shutdown here. But Trump this year, at least the White House just announced a few days ago that the American delegation will be downgraded and led by a cabinet-level official this year. Last year, it was the Vice President, Mike Pence. This year, it'll be Wilbur Ross, representing the highest-level U.S. participation there. And in 2017, when Trump did go to the East Asia Summit, he ended up leaving early before the plenary session, and he didn't actually deliver his speech, in which he would have addressed things like the South China Sea. But looking to Bangkok, the ASEAN obviously has a handful. I don't want to make it just sound like it's the East Asia Summit and the U.S. ASEAN summits that matter. But what are we expecting to see out of those upcoming meetings in Bangkok?
Yeah, so I think, there's with these summits, there's always a long agenda and a sort of ASEAN style of, they're trying to get a whole load of things to deal with, a whole menu of items. But I think there's two or three things that are of particular focus. I think one is this sort of almost yearly conversation we have about whether the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, the RCEP, the other major trade agreement that has been in conversation, the other one being the former TPP, now CPTPP, whether this is actually going to be finalized or they reach some kind of interim agreement as a face-saving measure. If that happens, that would be something that could be characterized as a significant development for trade, even though, as we've discussed before on the podcast, this really is bringing together several existing agreements already between these countries rather than a sort of new and far-ranging agreement. So that's one, I think. The other thing that's significant and important to watch is something we've also discussed before in detail, which is the Indo-Pacific vision. So this is something which has been discussed before. Other countries have come up with strategies, including Japan and Australia. But since the Trump administration has come up with the Free and Open Indo-Pacific strategy, we've had a lot more conversation about it. And ASEAN adopted its own outlook on the Indo-Pacific. So, Thailand's expected to at least try to stimulate the conversation on the Indo-Pacific concept and see if this is something which other players, external players, not only ASEAN but also other countries, can respond to it, and whether this is something which, it's something that people are talking about in terms of different countries and having different positions, or is it something that's actually going to formally make it in terms of shaping the regional architecture? So I think that is something that we can look to see how this Indo-Pacific concept is actually evolving. Is it something that's just sort of a discussion among various countries that's going to die out, or is it something that's here to stay and is on the official ASEAN agenda? Because once something is on the official ASEAN agenda, chances are it has to be sort of replicated and carried forward by other chairs. And next year, Vietnam is going to be the chair after Thailand, which would be another sort of interesting development in that sense.
Well, I guess we'll have to see what happens. For the Trump administration and the Indo-Pacific Strategy Report, of course, described this region as the United States' priority theater. But I think, the downgrading of the East Asia Summit participation this year, I think, is going to send the opposite message that the administration remains distracted by other issues, including certainly domestic politics in the United States, which remain in a precarious place, to say the least. Well,
Yeah, and I think as you've pointed out before, and you wrote a piece on this as well about the downgrading of the participation. I mean, this is an administration where President Trump clearly has a very strong role in terms of how foreign policy is made and priorities. So, not having him at these summits and downgrading the participation you know, has the effect of essentially begging the question that these countries are already asking, which is, well, unless President Trump actually shows up, we don't think that the United States is going to seriously follow through with these things. So that, in my view at least, is a very unnecessary sort of conversation that the United States is begging with this sort of downgrading of participation.
Yeah, I mean, it's a double-edged sword, because then if you do have Trump there, he might say or do something that you don't want him to say or do if you're an American ally or partner. So, yeah, but yeah. I agree. I mean, on balance, I think the optics are certainly a little bit paradoxical, given what the administration has repeatedly said in strategy documents about the region. But we'll see. You know, I even wonder if we might see a sudden change in travel plans. You know, Trump doesn't like to do long-distance travel, especially to Asia, if he doesn't have to. So the fact that he's not going to APEC now might open up a possibility of going to the East Asia Summit at the last minute. I'm not hopeful. I haven't heard anything to that effect, but, you know, it's certainly a possibility if they're trying to keep the president's, airplane miles, to a minimum, but, yeah, it's not a short trip to Bangkok by any means.
True.
All right. Well, Prashant, thanks for joining me.
Yeah. Good to be with you.
Great. Before we close out the podcast, just a quick note from our sponsor. This episode of the Asia Geopolitics Podcast is brought to you by Diplomat Risk Intelligence, or DRI. DRI is the consulting and analysis division of The Diplomat, the Asia Pacific's leading current affairs magazine. Since its launch in 2002, The Diplomat has been dedicated to quality analysis and commentary on events and trends in Asia and around the world, and is now one of the most respected publications covering the region. DRI inherits this approach and offers clients in the private, public, and nonprofit sectors worldwide access to an exclusive network of subject matter experts and analysts. Whatever your needs in the wider Asia-Pacific region, DRI can offer the knowledge and expertise necessary to anticipate and manage geopolitical and geoeconomic risk. For more information, please visit dri.thediplomat.com. So thanks a lot for listening. If you like what you heard on the podcast, make sure you subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. And if you've been a subscriber for a while but you haven't yet left us a review, you can go ahead and do that on either iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or any other number of podcast providers that we're available on. So thanks a lot for listening, and we'll be back soon with more.